Cassette 2, Side 2.
Chapter 10. Metz.
I'm sorry, Dr. Metz. The captain is with Thomas Orley in the weapons section. If there's anything I can do...
As usual, Vice-Captain Takata Jim was unfailingly polite. His Anglic diction, even while breathing oxy water, was almost perfect. Ignacio Metz couldn't help smiling in approval. He had a particular interest in Takata Jim.
No, Vice-Captain, I just stopped by the bridge to see if the survey party had reported in.
They haven't. We can only wait. Metz tisked. He had already concluded that Hikahi's party was destroyed.
Ah, well, I don't suppose there has been any offer of negotiations by the Galactics yet?
Takata Jim shook his large, mottled gray head left to right.
Regrettably, no, sir. They appear more interested in slaughtering each other. Every few hours, it seems, yet another battle fleet enters Kithemene's system to join in the free-for-all. It may be a while before anyone initiates diplomacy.
Dr. Metz frowned at the illogic of it. If the Galactics were rational, they'd let Streaker hand her discovery over to the Library Institute and have done with it. Then everyone would share equally. But galactic civilization was unified more in the breach than in fact, and too many angry species had big ships and guns. Here we are, he thought, in the middle, with something they all want. It can't just be that giant fleet of ancient ships. Something more must have set them off. Gillian Baskin and Tom Orley picked something up out there in the shallow cluster. I wonder what it was.
Will you be wanting me to join you for dinner this evening, Dr. Metz?
Metz blinked.
What day was it?
Ah, yes, Wednesday.
Of course, Vice-Captain. Your company and conversation would be appreciated as usual. Shall we say six-ish?
Perhaps 1900 hours would be better, sir. I get off duty then.
Very well, until then.
Takata Jim nodded. He turned and swam back to his duty station. Metz watched the Finn appreciatively.
He's the best of my Stenos, Metz thought. He doesn't know I'm his godfather, his gene father, but I am proud nonetheless.
All the dolphins aboard were of Terciops amicus stock, but some had genetic grafts from Stenos bretonensis, the deep-water dolphin that had always been the closest to the bottlenose in intelligence. Wild bretonensis had a reputation for insatiable curiosity and reckless disregard for danger. Metz had led the effort to have DNA from that species added to the Neo-Finn gene pool. On Earth, many of the new Stenos had turned out very well, showing streaks of initiative and individual brilliance. But a reputation for harsh temperament had lately caused some resentment in Earth's coastal communities. He had worked hard to convince the Council that it would be an important gesture to appoint a few Stenos to positions of responsibility on the first Dolphin-crewed starship. Takata Jim was his proof. Coldly logical, primly correct, the Finn used Anglic almost to the exclusion of Trinary, and seemed impervious to the whale dream that so enthralled older models like Crydike. Takata Jim was the most manlike dolphin Metz had ever met. He watched the vice-captain manage the bridge crew, with none of the little canique parables Crydike was always inserting, but rather with Anglic precision and brevity. Never a word wasted. Yes, he thought. This one is going to get a good report when we get home.
Dr. Metz?
Metz turned and recoiled at the size of the dolphin that had silently come up beside him.
What? Oh, Githad John, you startled me. What can I do for you?
A truly large dolphin grinned at him. His blunt mouth, his counter-shaded body and bulging eyes would have told Metz everything about him. if he hadn't already known.
Beresa attenuata.
The human savored the thought. So beautiful and savage. My most secret project. And nobody, not even you, Cathar John, knows that you are more than just another Stenos.
Forgive the interruption, Dr. Metz, but the chimp scientist, Charles Dart, has asked to speak with you. I think the little ape wants to bitch to somebody again.
Metz frowned. Cathar John was only a bosun and not expected to be as refined as Takata Jim. Still, there were limits, even considering the giant's hidden background. I will have to talk to this fellow, he reminded himself. This kind of attitude will never do. Please inform Dr. Dart that I'm on my way, he told the Finn. I'm finished here for now.
Chapter 11 Crydike and Orly. So, we're armed again? Crydike sighed. After a fashion. Thomas Orly looked up from the newly repaired missile tubes and nodded. That's about as good as we're going to get, Crydike. We weren't expecting trouble when we popped into a battle at Morgan Transfer Point. We were lucky to get away with as little damage as we took. Crydike agreed.
Just so. If only I had reacted faster.
Orly noticed his friend's mood. He pursed his lips and whistled. His breather mask amplified a faint sound-shadow picture. The little echo danced and hopped like a mad elf from corner to corner in the oxy-water-filled chamber. Workers in the weapons pod lifted their narrow, sound-sensitive jaws to follow the skipping sonar image as it scampered, unseen, chittering in mock sympathy. When one commands, one is envied by people, but oh, the demands. The sound wraith vanished, but laughter remained. The crew of the weapons pod spluttered and squalled. Crydike let the mirth settle. Then from his brow came a pattern of chamber-filling clicks that merged to mimic the sounds of thunderclouds gathering. In the closed room, those present heard raindrops blown before the wind. Tom closed his eyes to let the sound image of a sea squall close over him. They stand in my road, the mad, ancient, nasty things. Tell them, move, or else. Orly bowed his head, acknowledging defeat. No one had ever beaten Crydike at Trinary Haiku. The admiring signs of the Fen only confirmed this. Nothing had changed, of course. As Orly and Crydike turned to leave the weapons pod, they knew that defiance alone would not get this crew through the crisis. There must be hope as well. Hope was scarce. Tom knew that Crydike was desperately worried about Hikahi, though he hid it well. When they were out of earshot, the captain asked,
"Has Jillian made any progress studying that thing we found? The cause of all this trouble?"
Tom shook his head. "I haven't spent more than an hour with her in 2 days." Crydike sighed.
"It would have been nice to know what the Galactics think we found. Ah, well."
They were stopped by a sudden whistle. Tisht, the ship's fourth officer, flew into the hallway in a cloud of bubbles.
"Crydike, Tom, sonar reports a dolphin at long range, to the east, swimming this way at high speed."
Crydike and Orly looked at each other. Then Tom nodded at the captain's unspoken command. "Can I take Tisht and 20 Fen?"
"Yes. Get a team ready, but don't leave until we find out more. You may want to take more than 20, or it may be hopeless to go at all."
Tom saw pain in the captain's eye. He motioned for Lieutenant Tisht to follow and swam rapidly down the flooded corridor toward the outlock. Chapter 12 Galactics. Feeling the combined joys of patronhood and command, the Soro Krat watched the Gelo, the Paha, the Pila, her creatures, as they guided the Soro fleet toward battle once more. "Mistress," the Gelo detection officer announced, "we are approaching the water world at 1/4 light speed per your instructions." Krat acknowledged with a bare flick of her tongue, but secretly she was happy. Her egg was healthy. When they won here, she would be due to go home and mate once more, and the crew of her flagship was working together like a finely tuned machine.
"The fleet is 1 paktar ahead of timetable, mistress," the detection officer announced.
Of all the client species owing allegiance to the Soro, the Gelo were special to Krat. They were her own species' first clients, uplifted by the Soro long ago. The Gelo had in their turn become patrons as well, and brought 2 more client races into the clan. They had made the Soro proud. The chain of uplift went on. Deep in the past had been the progenitors who began galactic law. Since then, race had aided race to sentience, taking indentured service as payment. Many millions of years ago, the ancient Luber had uplifted the Puber, or so the library said. The Luber were now long extinct. The Puber still existed somewhere, though now degenerate and decadent. Before their decadence, though, the Puber raised up the Hull, who in turn made clients of Krat's stone-chomping Soro ancestors. Shortly thereafter, the Hull retired to their home world to become philosophers. Now the Soro themselves had many clients. Their most successful upspring were the Gelo, the Paha, and the Pila. Krat could hear the high voice of the Pila tactician, Kubber Kabub, haranguing its subordinates to coax information she wanted from the shipboard mini-library. Kubber Kabub sounded frightened. Good. It would try harder if it feared her. Alone of those aboard, the Pila were mammals, short bipeds from a high-gravity world. They had become a powerful race in many galaxy-wide bureaucratic organizations, including the important Library Institute. The Pila had raised clients of their own, bringing credit to the clan. Still, too bad the Pila were no longer indentured clients. It would have been nice to meddle with their genes again. The furry little sophants shed and had a bothersome odor. No client race was perfect. Only 200 years ago, the Pila had been thoroughly embarrassed by the humans of Earth. The affair was difficult and expensive to cover up. Krat did not know all of the facts, but it had something to do with the Earthling's son. Since then, the Pila had hated humans passionately. Krat's mating claw throbbed as she thought of Earthlings. In just a few generations, they had become almost as great a nuisance as the sanctimonious Kanton, or the devil trickster Timbrimey. The Soro patiently awaited an opportunity to erase the blot on their clan honor. Fortunately, humans were pathetically ignorant and vulnerable. Perhaps the chance had already come. How delicious it would be to have Homo sapiens assigned to the Soro as indentured foster clients. It could happen. Then what changes could be made? How humans might be molded? Krat looked at her crew and wished she were free to meddle, alter, shape at will, even those adult species. So much could be done with them, but that would require changing the rules. If the upstart water mammals from Earth had discovered what she thought they had, then the rules might be changed, if the progenitors had indeed come back from the mists of time. How ironic that the newest spacefaring race should discover this derelict fleet. She almost forgave dolphins for existing, for giving those humans the status of patrons.
"Mistress," the tall Gelo announced, "the Jofer-Thenanin Alliance has broken up, fighting among themselves. This means they are no longer preeminent."
"Maintain vigilance," Krat sighed.
The Gelo shouldn't make too much out of one little act of treachery.
Alliances would form and dissolve until one emerged supreme. She intended that that force be sorrow. The dolphins must be here. When she won this battle, she would pry the handless ones out from their underwater sanctuary and make them tell all. With a languid wave of her left paw, she summoned the pill librarian from its niche. "Look into the data on these water creatures we pursue," she told it. "I want to know more about their habits, what they like and dislike. It is said their bonds to their human patrons are weak and corruptible. Give me a lever to pervert these dolphins."
Cubberkebub bowed and withdrew into the library section with the rayed spiral glyph above its opening. Krat felt destiny all around her. This place in space was a fulcrum of power. She didn't need instruments to tell her that.
"I will have them. The rules will be changed."
Chapter 13. Toshio. Toshio found Satata by the bole of the giant drill tree. The fin had been thrown against the monstrous plant and crushed. Her harness was a jumble of broken pieces. Toshio stumbled through the ruined undergrowth, whistling a trinary call when he felt able. Mostly, he tried very hard to stay on his feet. He hadn't walked much since leaving Earth. Bruises and nausea didn't help much. He found Kehith lying on a soft bed of grass-like growth. His harness was intact, but the dolphin planetologist had already bled to death from 3 deep gashes in his belly. Toshio made a mental note of the spot and moved on. Closer to the shore, he found Satima. The little female was bleeding and hysterical, but alive. Toshio bound her wounds with flesh foam and repair tape. Then he took the manipulator arms of her harness and used a large rock to pound them into the loam. It was the best he could do to bind her to the ground before the 5th wave hit. It was more a flooding than a wave. Toshio clung to a tree as it flowed past, tugging at him and rising almost to his neck. As soon as the wave began to recede, he let go and floundered over to Satima. He groped until he found the catch on her harness, then released her to float in the growing back tow. He pushed hard to join the flood and keep from being left behind. He was struggling to shove her around a clump of shrubs against the growing pull of the backwash, when a swift motion in a tree overhead caught his eye. The movement didn't fit into the overall pattern of swaying subsidence. He looked up and met the gaze of a pair of small black eyes. There was little time for more than a startled double-take before the tide pulled him and Satima straight through the obstruction and into a small, recently made marsh. Toshio was suddenly too busy to look anywhere but straight ahead. He had to pull Satima down the last few yards of slippery sea plant, taking care not to reopen her wounds. In the last few minutes it had seemed she was more lucid. Her delphin squeakings were starting to take on form and sound like trinary words. A whistle brought Toshio's head up. Kipiru was only 40 meters offshore, driving the sled toward him. The fin had on a breather, but he could still signal.
"Satima!"
Toshio shouted to the wounded dolphin.
"Go to the sled! Go to Kipiru!" "Lash her to an air dome," he called to Kipiru. "And keep your eye on that sonar screen. Get back out there when you see a wave coming."
Kipiru tossed his head. As soon as Satima was 100 feet out, he used the sled to herd her toward deeper water. 5 accounted for. That left Hist and Hikahi. Toshio climbed back up the sea plant and stumbled into the undergrowth once again. The territory of his mind seemed as torn up and desolated as the island he trod upon. He had seen too many corpses for one day, too many dead friends. He realized now that he had been unfair to the Finns all along. It had been unjust to blame them for teasing him. They couldn't help the way they were built. All of man's genetic meddling notwithstanding, dolphins had been dealing with humanity on a level of good-natured derision since the first person paddled a log canoe out to sea. That pathetic image had been enough to set a pattern that uplift could only alter, not eliminate. And why eliminate it? Toshio now saw that those humans he had known on Calathea, who worked best with dolphins, had had a special type of personality, generally featuring a mixture of a thick skin, firmness, and a willing sense of humor. No one worked long with fins who hadn't earned their respect. He hurried over to a gray form that lay in the underbrush. But no, it was Satata again. She had been moved by the last wave. Toshio stumbled on. Dolphins were quite well aware of what mankind had done for them. Uplift was a painful process, but none of them would go back to the whale dream if they could help it. The Finns knew as well that the loose codes that ruled behavior among the galactic races, rules established in the library for eons, would have let humanity demand 100,000 years of servitude from its clients. Men had collectively shuddered at the thought. Homo sapiens was barely that age. If mankind did have a patron out there, one strong enough to lay claim to the title, that species wasn't going to pick up Tursiops amicus as an added bonus. There wasn't a Finn alive who wasn't aware of Earth's attitude. There were dolphins on the Terrigan's Council, as well as chimpanzees. Toshio knew at last how he had hurt Kipiru with his words during their struggle at sea. Most of all, he regretted the remark about Calathea. Kipiru would willingly die 1,000 times to save the humans of Toshio's homeworld. Toshio's tongue would fall off before he said such things again. Ever. He staggered into a clearing. There, in a shallow pool, lay a Tursiops dolphin.
Ikahi!
She was scratched and battered. Bloody trails lay along her sides. But she was awake. And as Toshio started forward, she called out.
Stay there, Sharp Eyes. Don't move. We have company here.
Toshio stopped in his tracks. Hikahi's command was specific, yet the need to go to her was urgent. The dolphin's scratches looked dangerous. If there were slivers of metal lodged under the skin, they had to be removed soon, before blood poisoning set in. And it wasn't going to be easy getting Hikahi out to sea.
Hikahi, there'll be another wave soon. It may reach this high. We've got to be ready for it. Stay, Toshio. The wave will not reach here. Besides, look around. See how much more important this is?
For the first time, Toshio noticed the clearing. The pool was set near one side, with scratch marks all around, indicating that it had been recently dug. Then he saw that the manipulator arms from Hikahi's harness were missing. Then who... Toshio's perception shifted. He saw twisted debris at the far end of the clearing, scattered through the undergrowth, and recognized the fragments of a ruined, shattered village. In the chronic shimmering of a Kithrupan forest, he saw the fragments of rude, torn, crudely woven nets, scattered pieces of wrecked thatching, and bits of sharp metal crudely bound to wooden staves. In the tree branches he saw fleet movements. Then, one by one, small, splayed, web-fingered hands appeared, followed by slowly peeking, shining black eyes that peered back at him from under low, greenish brows.
Abhos, he whispered.
I saw one earlier, then forgot. They look presentient.
Yes,
Hikahi sighed.
And this makes secrecy more vital than ever. Quickly, Sharp Eyes, tell me what has happened.
Toshio related only what he had done since the first wave struck, leaving out only his battle with Kipiru. It was hard to concentrate, with eyes in the trees staring down at him, then skittishly darting under cover whenever he glanced their way. He barely finished his story as the last wave arrived.
Breakers could be seen driving up the sloping shore with a white foaming. But Hikaki was right. The water wouldn't rise this high.
"Toshio," Hikaki whistled, "you've done very well. You may have saved these little people as well as ourselves. Brukida will succeed. He will bring help. So saving me is not that important. You must do as I say. Have Kipiru dive at once. He must stay out of sight and remain quiet as possible as he searches for bodies and debris. You must bury Satata and Kehith and gather the fragments of their harnesses. When help comes, we must be able to move quickly."
"Are you sure you'll be all right? Your wounds?"
"I'll be fine. My friends keep me wet. The trees overhang to keep me hidden. Watch the skies, Sharp Eyes. Don't be seen. When you're finished, I hope to have coaxed our little hosts into trusting you."
She sounded tired. Toshio was torn. Finally, he sighed and turned back to the forest. He forced himself to run through the broken foliage, following the receding waters to the shore. Kipiru was just emerging as he arrived. The Finn had removed his breather and wore an air dome instead. He reported finding the body of Phippet, the dolphin supposed lost earlier to the killer weed. The sucker-bruised body must have been torn loose during the tsunami.
"Any sign of Hist?"
Toshio called. Kipiru answered negative. Toshio passed on Hikahi's command and watched as the sled sank below again. For a moment he stood there, looking out over the west. Kithrop's reddish sun was setting. A few stars poked rays through scattered clouds, which were beginning to look ominous. Toshio decided against taking off his dry suit, though he compromised by pulling the rubberized headpiece off. The breeze was chilling, but a huge relief. If the battle in space continued, Toshio saw no sign of it. Kithrop's rotation had taken the shining globe of plasma and debris out of sight. Toshio lacked the will to shake his fist, but he grimaced toward the southern sky, hoping the galactics had wiped each other out. It wasn't likely. There would be victors, and someday soon they would be down here looking for dolphins and men. Toshio pulled his shoulders back in spite of his fatigue and walked with deliberateness toward the forest and the protecting, overhanging trees. They found the young man and the dolphin shortly after landing. The two were huddled together under a crude shelter, which dripped warm rain in long rivulets. Lightning flashes drowned out the muffled yellow light from lamps the rescuers brought. In the first flash, Thomas Orley thought he saw a half-dozen small, squat figures clustered around the Earthling and the Calathian. But by the time he and his partner had shoved through the undergrowth for a better view, the animals, or whatever they were gone. His first fear that they had been carrion eaters disappeared when he saw Toshio move. Still, he kept his right hand on the butt of his needler and held up the lantern to let Hannes Suwesti pass underneath. Orley looked carefully around the clearing, taking in the smells and sounds of the living surface of the metal mound, memorizing details.
"Are they all right?" he asked after a few seconds.
"Shh! It's okay, Toshio. It's just me, Hannes," he heard the engineer mutter. The fellow sounded downright maternal.
"Yes, Mr. Orley," Suwesi called back. "They're both awake, but not in much shape for talking."
Thomas Orley took in the clearing once more, then moved over to set the lamp beside Suwesi. "This lightning would cover anything," he said. "I'm going to call up the mechanicals to get these two out of here quick as possible." He touched a button on the rim of his faceplate and whistled quickly in perfect trinary. The message lasted 6 seconds. It was said that Thomas Orley could actually speak primal Delphin, though no human had ever witnessed it. "They'll be here in a few minutes." He squatted next to Toshio, who was sitting up now that Suwesi had moved over to Hikahi.
"Hello, Mr. Orley," the boy said.
I'm sorry we dragged you away from your work.
That's all right, son. I've been wanting to have a look around up here anyway. This gave the captain a good excuse to send me. After we get you started toward the ship, Hannes and Tish and I will go on to look over that ship that crashed. Now do what you can to lead us to Statata and Kihith. We want to comb this island clean before the storm passes. Toshio nodded.
Yes, sir. I should be able to stumble around that long. I don't suppose anyone's found Hist.
No, we're worried about that, but nowhere near as worried as when Brukita came back alone. Kipiru's told us most of the story. That Finn thinks rather highly of you, you know. You did quite a job here. Toshio turned away, as if ashamed to receive the praise. Orly looked at him curiously. He had never given much thought to the Midi. During the first part of the voyage, the youth had seemed bright, but a bit irresponsible. Later, after they found the derelict fleet, he had turned morose, as their chances of ever going home diminished. Now there was this new note. It was too soon to tell the long-term effects, but this had clearly been a rite of passage for Toshio. Humming sounds drifted up from the beach. Soon two spider-like mechanicals strode into view, a hammocked and harnessed dolphin piloting each one. Toshio sighed a little raggedly as Orly helped him stand. Then the older man stooped to pick up an object from the ground. He hefted it in his left hand. A scraper, isn't it? Made from bits of metal fish spine glued to a wood handle.
I guess so.
Do they have much of a language yet?
No, sir. Well, the rudiments, they seem to be stabilized. Strict hunter-gatherers. Hikahi guesses they've been stuck for 500,000 years.
Orly nodded. This native species looked ripe at first glance, a pre-sentient race at just the right stage for uplift. It was a miracle some galactic patron line hadn't snapped them up already, for client status and an eon of servitude. Now the men and Fen of Streaker had yet another obligation, and secrecy was more important than ever. He put the artifact in his pocket, then laid his hand on Toshio's shoulder. "Well, you can tell us all about it back on the ship, son. In the meantime, you have some pondering to do."
"Sir?"
Toshio looked up in confusion. "Well, it isn't everybody who gets to name a future space-faring race. You know, the Fen will be expecting you to make up a song about it." Toshio looked at the older man, uncertain if he was joking. But Thomas Orly had on his usual enigmatic expression. Orly glanced up at the rain clouds. As the mechanicals moved in to claim Hikahi, he stepped back and smiled at the curtain, which temporarily hung across the theater of the sky. Part 2. Currents. For the sky and the sea, and the sea and the sky lay like a load on my weary eye, and the dead lay at my feet. S.T. Coleridge. Chapter 14. Denny. Charles Dart pulled away from the polarization microscope and growled an oath. In a habit he had spent half his life trying to break, he absently laid his forearms over his head and tugged on his hairy ears. It was a simian contortion no one else aboard ship could easily duplicate. Had he noticed he was doing it, he would have quit instantly. Of a crew of 150, only 8 aboard the Streaker even had arms or external ears. One of these shared the dry lab with him. Commenting on Charles Dart's body behaviors did not occur to Denny Sudman. She had long ceased to notice such things as his loose, rolling gait, his shrieking chimpanzee laughter, or the sparse fur that nearly covered his body.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"Are you still having trouble with those core samples?"
Dark nodded absently, staring at the screen.
Yeah.
His voice was low and scratchy. At his best, Charles Dart sounded like a man speaking with gravel in his throat. Sometimes, when he had something complicated to say, he unconsciously moved his hands in the sign language of his youth.
I can't make any sense out of these isotope concentrations, he growled. And there are minerals in all the wrong places. Siderophiles without metals. Intricate crystals at a depth where there shouldn't be such complexity. Captain Crydike's silly restrictions are crippling my work. I wish he'd let me do some seismic scans and deep radar.
He swiveled about in his seat to look at Denny earnestly, as if hoping she would concur. Denny's smile was broad under high cheekbones, her almond eyes narrowed in amusement.
Sure, Charlie, why not? Here we are in a crippled ship, hidden under an ocean on a deadly world, with fleets from a dozen arrogant and powerful patron lines fighting over the right to capture us, and you want to start setting off explosions and casting gravity beams around? Wonderful idea. Say, I've got an even better one. Why don't we just take out a large sign and wave it at the sky, something that says, Yoo-hoo, beasties, come and eat us. Hmm?
Charlie cast a sidelong look at her, one of his rare, unhinged, lopsided grins.
Oh, they wouldn't have to be big gravity scans, and I'd only need a few teeny-tiny explosions for seismography. The ETs wouldn't notice those, you think?
Denny laughed. What Charlie wanted was to make the planet ring like a bell, so he could trace the patterns of seismic waves in the interior. Teeny, tiny explosions, indeed. More likely detonations in the kiloton range. Sometimes Charlie seemed so single-minded a planetologist that it bothered Denny. This time, however, she was obviously having some fun at his expense. He laughed as well, letting out brief whoops that echoed off the stark white walls of the dry lab. He thumped the table beside him. Grinning, Denny filled a zip case with papers.
You know, Charlie, there are volcanoes going off all the time, a few degrees away from here. If you're lucky, one might start right near us.
Charlie looked hopeful.
Gee, you think so?
Sure. And if the ETs start bombing the planet to get at us, you'll have plenty of data from all the near misses. That is, if they don't bomb so hard as to make geophysical analyses of Kithrop moot. I envy you your potential silver lining. In the meantime, I intend to forget about my own frustrating research and go get some lunch. Coming?
Nah, thanks, though. I brought my own. I think I'll stay and work for a while.
Suit yourself. Still, you might try to see more of the ship other than your quarters and this lab.
I talk to Metz and Brukita all the time on screen. I don't need to wander around gawking at this Rube Goldberg contraption that can't even fly anymore.
And besides,
she prompted. Charlie grinned.
And besides, I hate getting wet. I still think you humans should have worked on Dog second after casting your spells on us pan-types. Dolphins are all right. Some of my best friends are Finns. But they were a funny bunch to try to make into a space-traveling race.
He shook his head with an expression of sad wisdom. Obviously, he thought the whole uplift process on Earth would have been better handled had his people been in charge.
Well, they're superb space pilots, for one thing, Denny suggested. Look at how hot a star jockey Kipiru is.
Yeah, and look at what a jerk-off that Finn can be when he's not piloting. Honestly, Denny, this trip has made me wonder if Finns are really ready for spaceflight. Have you seen how some of them have been acting since we got into trouble? All the pressure is making some of them unravel, especially some of Metz's big Stenos.
You're not being charitable, Denny chided. Nobody ever expected this mission to be so stressful. I think most of the Fen are doing marvelously. Look at how Krydike slipped us away from that trap at Morgren.
Charlie shook his head.
I don't know. I still wish there were more men and chimps aboard.
1 century. That's how much longer than dolphins chimps had been a recognized spacefaring species. Denny figured 1 million years from now they would still hold a patronizing attitude over that lead.
Well, if you're not coming, I'm off.
Denny took her notecase and touched the palm plate by the door. See you, Charlie. The chimp called after her before the door hissed shut.
By the way, if you run into Takat or Saut, have them call me, eh? I'm thinking these subduction anomalies may be paleotechnic. An archaeologist may be interested.
Denny let the door close without answering. If she didn't acknowledge Charlie's request, she could feign ignorance later. There was no way she would go out of her way to speak to Saut, whatever the significance of Charlie's find. Avoiding that particular dolphin was already taking up too much of her time.
This ends side 2 of cassette 2.